Welcome to Hot D, the officially unofficial podcast for House of the Dragon on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 1, Episode 5, We Light the Way. It's the feedback episode. Aaron, how are we doing in the feedback department?
We got a healthy amount. You can send feedback into hotd@baldmove.com if that's something you're inclined to do to get a chance to be read. Lots and lots and lots of people took us up on the matter, so let's get to it. Mike is up first and says, hey, can you enlighten me on the hair color heredability in the universe? If Targaryen has a baby with someone with dark hair, will that baby almost always have silver hair? Do two Targaryens always have silver haired children? I was just wondering what the possible implications would be should Rhaenyra have a baby with dark hair and the likelihood of this happening. Oh, man. Westerosi Punnett Squares. What a fabled history they have. I'm going to be honest. I don't 100% know. It seems like in George's universe, this stuff is very heritable. And it's one of the many reasons Targaryens are very incestual, is they are trying to preserve their primarily dragon riding. They're big proponents of the only Targaryens can ride dragons, or I'm sorry, only dragon riders can ride dragons. There was more historical dragon riders than Targaryens, but they're the last of the house of those houses left. But they also, want to continue on the legacy of their platinum hair and their purple eyes. Purple eyes more of a book thing than the show thing, but. I know canonically there are instances of black-haired children being born to Targaryens, but especially when you're talking Fire and Blood and the world of Ice and Fire, you can't ever dismiss the possibility that these might be bastard children. You know that the queen stepped out on the king, or the princess stepped out on the prince, and so it's like, and 300 years later, who the hell would ever know, right?
Yeah.
And also, as the Targaryens do start to intermix with, people like the people from the Vale and the Baratheons and whatnot. Once you get a little bit of that dark hair, brown eyed genetics in the mix, then, if it's anything like real world genetics, which I don't think it is, you're going to always have a chance of that popping up at some point. So I think that in the universe, they think it's super heritable. That seems clear. Like, Ned Stark built his whole case of Lannister incest based on, Robert's the Baratheon seed being strong and breeding true through several generations. I don't think that'd hold up in a modern day court, but is what they had at the time. What do you have any thoughts as a non-book reader?
No, I'm just waiting to see if they do anything with it. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, I think I said this on a podcast a couple weeks ago. Like, my understanding of Westerosi genetics is it doesn't really work anything like we do here. Like, it seems like your skin color and hair color, eye color roughly corresponds to like what latitude you're from. And your ancestry goes back to like thousands and thousands of years here on Earth. Westeros, with magical seasons and magical lengths, summer and spring and all that being more magical than it is like based on any kind of planetary tilt or closeness to the sun or what have you. I don't know that would necessarily be true. It might be a lot more variable. So, but in universe, I think it definitely would raise eyebrows if you had a Targaryen couple and they just pumped out dark haired child after dark haired child.
I want to see that happen. And then I want to see a plot where somebody is so desperate to become a dragon rider that they just lay out in the sun, hoping they can bleach their hair enough to pass as Targaryen.
Sure, sure.
That's
what
I want.
What is it that you put in your hair to encourage? Is it like apple cider vinegar, or is it, because like, isn't there something you can spray in your hair during the summertime to kind of encourage it to go blonde? Bleach.
Maybe.
It's for bleach. You spray 50-50 Clorox and apple cider vinegar, I think, is what, mm-hmm. what does the trick. Let's move on to Leah. Says, I think you're missing a female perspective in the discussion about whether rebellious teenager Rhaenyra drinks the plan T. Of course, this is for the previous episode. This is a girl whose greatest fear is dying in childbirth and by extension being pregnant. She absolutely is going to drink that tea. Any teenage girl who doesn't want to be pregnant drinks that tea regardless of what it looks like in front of her father. My first thought watching the episode was, now that she knows that moon tea exists, does she secretly use it in the future? Marriage probably looks a lot easier now that she knows she can avoid being pregnant if she gets a maester on her side. And now that she's had her eyes open to the wonders of sex, will her having or not having an heir of her own be a point of discussion for the lords who have to decide whether to who to back in a civil war? As you pointed out, she's not very politically strategic. So I say she goes heavy on that moon tea and stays in peak dragon riding shape. That's an interesting idea. A woman who just refuses to have an heir because, like, I ain't dying in childbirth. I'm going to keep this hot dragon body. Fuck all that stuff. I was a little bit muddled in my calculus because as I was recounting like the different options at Rhaenyra, like I was taken from the one of them was I was considering like, well, maybe Rhaenyra just didn't have sex with anybody. And that's stupid. She did. We saw it. So
yeah, totally.
What do you think about this feedback, Jim?
Yeah, it makes sense. That would probably be pretty scary. I don't know. As far as her, like, not her trying to ensure that she doesn't have an heir.
In some way she has to, right?
I could see it. Yeah, she doesn't have to, especially not right away. Certainly people are going to be pressuring her too, but
if she takes the dream / prophecy seriously, she almost has to ensure that.
But does she
align?
Does she?
Yeah, I guess there's lots of other Targaryens.
No, I mean, does she take it seriously? It's like, okay, her father's telling her that he takes it very seriously. But he's constantly having to remind her of it, right? And
it seems like when she was talking to Sir Criston, that she is cognizant of it. You know, she talks about the duty to the realm. And I guess that's like,
That whole conversation is tinted with like, you were just kind of a one night thing, dude. Yeah, you're just like a fling, you know?
Yeah.
I was reading less, oh, I have a duty to the realm, and more, I just don't want to get that serious with you, Kristen.
Sure, I like you. I don't know if I like you.
I'll keep banging you, but a relationship? What are you talking about?
I don't know that I agree.
No,
it does. But it's to the extent that I don't know. I think she takes the duty to the realm part seriously. Whether she takes the Song of Ice and Fire part of it seriously, I think remains to be seen. Mm-hmm. And also, like, I don't know that Viserys takes it that seriously too, because like, I still don't think that he's treating Rhaenyra like a true equal. Like you think he would if he's really hellbound in sitting her on the throne and making sure she's ready to defend the realm against all this, you know, ice zombie shit that he thinks is coming.
Yeah. And he's had a few years at this point. So,
yeah, it's like one of those things where like, I feel like sometimes my mom would get uncomfortable with the state of sloth or I don't know, messiness in the family. My mom was one of the chief contributors, you know, ones that likes to sleep in the weekends and maybe not go to bed with the dishes done. And she would get up and harumph and be like, this family's got to make some changes around here. We got to do just because she herself was feeling guilty about it.
Yeah.
So she had to like, but then it's like when it comes time to do something, you know, it's 1 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. She's still honk shoe. Is Viserys that kind of type where he's like, yeah, we got to do something about these ice zombies at the wall. And then like, oh God, I got these boils and boy, this wine tastes really good. And where's Alicent at? Like he just doesn't have the dedication to it. Not really.
Could be. I can see that.
Anyway, let's move on to Sarah. She says, I was just listening to your episode 4 feedback cast, and I got to the part about how dragons are controlled. When it's mentioned that we don't think that they're controlled mentally and that warging probably isn't an option, it reminded me of the end of Game of Thrones where Bran is inquiring about where Drogon is. He says, let me see if I can find them or something along those lines. And now I'm wondering why. Does Bran just want to keep tabs on Drogon? Does he think if Drogon is close enough, he can control Drogon, Hodor style? What do you guys think? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Happy to have the Game of Thrones world content from you guys again. Well, thank you.
Oof. I don't quite remember that scene, but I would say Bran is definitely an exception. Like, anything that applies to Bran doesn't necessarily apply to any other
That's character. Exactly right. And I don't know if, like, I would say that, like, warging probably isn't an option. To me, I know that there's things in the material that speculate the dragons are too mentally strong to be dominated like that. But that might be more Targaryen bullshit, you know, propaganda. Sure. And then, like, it might be true that, like, your average, you know, I don't think, what is it, Viremer of Six Skins? He was, like, this pretty famed warg from Beyond the Wall and in some of the later Game of Thrones books, Song of Ice and Fire books. I don't know that he could pull something like that down, but, like, Bran is... You know, it's like comparing Superman to Captain America. It's like, sure, Captain American could do a lot of shit, but he can't plunge into the heart of the sun. Mm-hmm. You know? like Superman can. So I think the if anyone could warg into a dragon, it'd probably be Bran. There's a lot, and just because, and also the show, especially when you get into season, like halfway through season 6, 7, and 8, it is really best thought of as George Martin fan fiction. Mm-hmm. You know, it might be right, it might be wrong, but George had nothing to do with it, and there was not a lot to go on. So we'll see. And we've only seen one Stark. And he was just there to gruffly swear allegiance to Rhaenyra in, what, the first episode? I don't know if we're going to get any warging. Although, stay tuned to the very end of this episode if you want to hear the hot new Valyrian tinfoil theory of the week regarding some possible First Men BS happening. Tori from Dallas has got feedback from the King of the Narrow Sea. So from timestamps 3117 to 3144-45, the camera work has Daemon and Rhaenyra swapping their positions. In one scene, Rhaenyra is behind Daemon looking around. In the other scene, Rhaenyra and Daemon are getting closer and closer until we eventually see that scene continues playing with the kiss. Could this camera work be intended to show us that we don't really know the truth of the episode, or am I crazy? I'm also reminded of, like, the way the camera work in this episode works, and how we never really got to see whether Daemon said, you know, joked about his, nephew, Balin being heir for a day.
Oh, right. Yeah.
To me, I think this is the show playing, respecting its heritage of this kind of messy, gossipy history book. And yes, I do think it's deliberate, some of these choices where, why did Sir Criston murder this guy? I mean, we saw what led up to it, but what actually made him snap? I don't know, because we were looking at Daemon at the time, and eyewitness accounts are notoriously center, and there's a whole bunch of dancing, fighting people between us, so we don't get the view. There's a lot of stuff in this where it seems like they're trying to get that feel of reading Fire and Blood, where, you know, this maester says this, this septa says this, mushroom says this. Who's right and who's wrong? And I think it's one of the more entertaining aspects of the show, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Mushroom might have gotten a pretty good look at what started it. He was up on a stage,
it's true,
right?
Banging those drums. Yeah, he might have been he certainly had a unique perspective as far as vantage point.
Uh-huh.
Ashley says, I keep hearing on multiple podcasts questions about why Daemon pulls Rhaenyra's hat off in the brothel. Seems obvious to me that it's purely because this is what he is attracted to sexually, as if he's psyching himself up for something to happen between them. In the first episode, Missaria confronts Daemon after he's unable to perform by offering to bring him a maiden, one she can arrange to have silver hair. To me, it seems clear that Daemon has long had this weird forbidden thing for his niece, or at least for the whole pure Targaryen blood mating paradigm. I'm less interested in exactly why, or he couldn't or wouldn't go through with it, but it seems he seems impetuous enough as a character that it makes sense to me that he may have been making it up as he went. It seemed less to me like some big plan to drag the reputation of the heir, and more like Daemon's primary motivation was to always, not give a fuck, and have wild flirty night on the town with a blonde teen who he thinks is cool. It makes Damon out to be like a McCoyle, you know, like he's just turned on by the idea of is he turned on by the idea to keep the bloodline pure, or is he turned on by the idea that like we as Targaryens get to do stuff that the average person doesn't?
Yeah, could be that the taboo. He's attracted to the taboo of it all.
Yeah, that could be too. I mean, Jesus, it seems like incest is a very popular category on all the top porn sites.
Right.
For whatever reason. Which has long been a like, what the fuck? You know, I've talked about this for like 5 years on podcasts. Like, are we sure this is something that we really want to encourage? You know, is it, you know, I get it. Step brother and step uncle and all that shit. But goddamn.
Well, come on. The step is just the veil that they use to make it.
No, I get. No, I
to,
I
to
yes.
make it somewhat. OK, but yeah,
100%. 100%.
But yeah, you could be right. I read it as like, you know, I'm all up in the politics of Game of Thrones, right? And the subterfuge and the plots, the wheels within wheels. And so when I see something like that, I'm like, well, he pulled the hood off so that she would be recognized by others. And
I think it's a valid way to read it.
It still could be. It doesn't appear like anything has come to fruition from that. Unless he's working with Mysteria, which would be super weird given all the scenes after.
Well,
so like,
definitely things came from it because she was seen there in his company, and then that got back to the king, which caused a big rift between Alicent. And now I totally can't imagine that Daemon intended all that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, even if he did,
but
say,
did Otto intend it? Because like Otto's statement of my girl, you've got to cleave to her and beg for her mercy, That doesn't ring nearly as well if Rhaenyra and Alicent are still tight and there isn't been this betrayal, you know, because Rhaenyra doesn't have to lie to her. So like, it's just on the realm of possibility that some alliance of Otto and Missaria intended to cause. And then it could be like as Littlefinger does a lot of things where it's not like he has a plan like a pool player. Like, I'm going to hit the 8 ball with the cue ball and it's going to bounce off this and hit the 9 ball into this corner pocket. It's more like I'm just going to slam this ball into this group of things as hard as I can. And I'll use my ability to think on the feet to play the balls as they lie.
Yeah,
you know,
he loves
like
breaking.
I don't have anything. I'm trying to climb this ladder. It behooves me to cause chaos above me so that I can maybe jump a few rings.
Yeah, I just haven't seen any indication that the primary player here was in on it. Like, if Daemon has to pull her hood back or take her hat off and pull his hood back so that people can recognize her, where is he in the rest of this plan? And why would he go along with it if he wasn't involved in the rest of the plan? You know?
Yeah. So it could be like he wanted them to be seen, because maybe that's also the kinky thing too. It's like, oh, I won't be. Yeah, sure. It's a voyeur thing. And it could also be just, oh, let me see that silver hair. I mean, who knows? He's he's a fucking crazy person, it seems like.
He is. Yeah, you could be right about the silver hair kink. There's still lots of hot D left to talk about. We'll be right back after the break.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th Annual Summer Badass Fest.
And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
And now, back to Hot D.
We have a lot of feedback about Sir Criston, as you can imagine. First up, Chris. I think this might be the first episode that I have major problems with. This wedding comes close to having a Martha. Why did you save that name? I think that's a Batman quote from Dawn of Justice moment for me. I didn't fully understand the leap they're making here. All right, before we go, I think Zach Taylor's DC project's largely a mess.
Garbage.
I thought that was actually somewhat cool. That, like, there is this historical artifact of Batman and Superman's moms having the same name, and in a moment of rage, that, like, cutting through enough of Batman that he stopped beating the holy hell out of Kal-El for a bit. Mm-hmm. What doesn't make sense is why Superman would call his mom by her given name. You know, right. Like, you know, make sure Martha's cool. Why would you? Like, you don't give the last name, which would be helpful for in a phone book kind of way. You don't specify that. You just like Martha, like, ah. So anyway, for one, there's no way Joffrey could be certain that Criston Cole is sleeping with the princess. There are many reasons a person can look sad at a wedding. Maybe his mom's died. OK, granted. But like I argue, I think if there's any people that could suss out the romantic entanglements of a room, it'd probably be people that have more experience trying to find hidden motivations, because they have to keep their own, you know, underground at pain of death, right? So, like, you know, if you either get that or you don't. And also, they could be wrong, you know, like he could have seen someone looking pensive and assumed it was that, right? You know, like he just happened to have a gut feeling and he's right.
I remember sitting in church when I was a kid, when I was like in my teens, and I, you know, you got crushes on people at church. You're sitting there, everybody's in the big room, and you're like kind of looking, you know, you're making eyes at him across the room. Right.
Yeah.
And I thought I was so smooth. I thought, nobody knows anything that's going on here. And now I look back on that as adult, and I'm like, I was a fucking idiot. Everybody knew. Everybody saw me looking at other people. Come on. What am I thinking?
True.
Right?
True.
And they were picking up on it. They knew. I feel like you're never as sly as you think you are. And Criston definitely has like those kind of eyes in this scene.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
And they're both like, you know, I know Kristen's a little older than Rhaenyra, but they're both relatively speaking young, you know? So their impetuousness and thinking they're cleverer than everyone in the room is probably going to be at its apex right about now. He mentions to walk up to a member of the Kingsguard and accuse him of having sex with the princess is such a reckless move. Seems like he could have been put to death just for slander. Put a pin in that. because another emailer has a connected point here in a minute. Lastly, I've watched this scene about three times now, and each time my understanding is that Joffrey is trying to make Kristen an ally, not an enemy. I don't really get the threat in the conversation because he also gave up his own secret. One of the writers said on the official podcast that Kristen was worried that if the secret got out, he would lose everything. But now he's brutally murdered someone in front of hundreds of witnesses and ruined the royal wedding. He's totally safe now. I get that they wanted their own red wedding moment, but this one just didn't make sense to me and wasn't earned at all. Well, like, no, clearly he doesn't think he's going to get away with this. He's going out to the God's Woods to kill himself immediately after.
He's like, this isn't logical. He snaps.
Yes.
He snaps. He freaks out. He snaps and he makes a huge mistake.
Yes. Yes. And I think it's a mistake to say that this was a calculated, logical. This isn't Michael Corleone settling all family business and then going out to Nevada so that he can go legit. Right. This is a man who is the whole like just got out of a conference of the queen where he confesses a secret and he's got this, you know, sword of Damocles heading over his head in his mind, because it's not like the princess forgave him. She just stood there in stony shock silence and dismissed him. Like, that could come back with a vengeance later on. Like, she could tell her husband the king, and it doesn't matter how clement she wants to be. It's so, like, there's so many things. And he's just sitting there, like I said, he looks like a landed fish throughout this whole thing. And I think this pushed him over the edge, and it was your classic crime of passion.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, 15 minutes ago, you asked Sir Christian Cole, hey, you going to beat to death anyone in this room? He'd be like, hell no. Hell no.
What are you talking about?
He ended up doing it. Right. Right. Nicole says, this is the related. You can now take the pin out of that one statement. How Sir Christian walks away as a hero. I think there's an easy way for Sir Christian to walk away as a hero after the wedding. The only three people to know about Rhaenyra and Christian's relationships are themselves and Alicent. Joffrey and Laenor are rightly guessed, but no one's ever confirmed it. The best plan for Christian is to tell the truth of Joffrey's conversation with them. He can then deny that he's in a relationship with Rhaenyra, and he was simply doing a sworn duty to protect her. Joffrey posed a threat if he became jealous or could derail a potential heir. Alicent can offer to stay silent, saving Christian and Rhaenyra's reputation, and negotiate her own children's safety and potentially more power for the High Towers in exchange. Rhaenyra have to agree or the truth will come out. This is a pretty... If everybody gets in a room and gets their story straight, I think this would work. Like Sir Criston being like, this guy came up and accused me of fucking the princess and I punched him. Like, what the hell? I'm her sworn shield. And then he pulled a knife on me. Can you fucking believe it? And yeah, I got a little bit out of hand, but what red blooded man of the realm, sworn brother of the Kingsguard wouldn't in these circumstances? I think that is a vicious lie and total horseshit, but yeah, I think that would really play in the realm.
The fly in their ointment here could be Laenor. I think that's the thing we've neglected to really discuss is how is this going to affect or change Laenor? Because he knows that Rhaenyra has someone, what do they call it?
Paramore,
yeah. He knows that Rhaenyra is out there doing something with somebody. And Joffrey sussed out that it was Kristen. And I think Laenor agreed. Laenor's definitely not going along with any lie you want to tell about this. So
does Laenor want to be king? Or because that's the other pressure is like, does he want to be king consort? Is he going to defy his parents? Is he going to blow up this marriage arrangement? Come out publicly as gay?
Sure, yeah. I think that's a big question, too. Yeah, it's a pressure point for him.
Because I don't think
maybe
he hates
could force him into lying, but oof.
Do you think he hates Rhaenyra after this?
No, I don't think he would assume that Rhaenyra had anything to do with this.
I wouldn't think so either. I would think that he thinks so. It's like, I don't think he would be out to get her.
Yeah. This is going to change him, right? I view Laenor as kind of like innocent, sweet, you know, between the woohoo and all the other scenes we've seen him in, his dragon riding capabilities. Mm. It seems like he's just kind of a kid in a lot of ways because he is young. But this is going to make him more cynical and
yeah, you'd
more
think.
Damaged, I would think.
But as you say, it's young. We're eventually going to have a flash forward and to the future. And, you know, we saw like Loras was pretty bereft when Renly was killed.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually got over it and found other men to pass the time with. So it's like time does heal all wounds. I definitely think that there's going to be a grudge between him and Sir Criston till the end of days.
Oh, yeah.
Like, 100%. I don't see how there couldn't be. It's one thing in the book where this, you know, like maybe Sir Criston had it out for him in a tourney duel, but like, you know, shit, people die in a tourney. Yeah. This is a lot different.
Yeah. And if he does become the king consort, that they'll be forced to work closely together from time to time. So that should be interesting.
Cindy says, to add to Sir Christian's motivations, remember that he found out the princess had drank in the moon tea. So in his mind, she might have already been pregnant and another betrayal. I didn't think this, but I wonder if that's where a young man's mind would go, that like, oh my God, she probably had my child and she drank the moon tea. And do you think there's any of that aspect to it?
Maybe. Especially with the conversation on the boat where he's spurned in another way. That could just add up.
In our non-medieval life, this occasionally comes up where, you know, the potential parents don't agree on the fate of a potential child. And they feel, you know, in our society at present, the woman gets to decide. I know that can cause some complex feelings over on the male side of things. And I would imagine that would go, you know, double if you're talking about a more explicitly medieval mindset. So that could be another layer of emotion or like you said, betrayal.
Yeah, we'll see if he brings it up, because so far all he's brought up is the relationship angle.
Yeah. Grace from London says, this man, Sir Criston, is the biggest drama knight I've ever seen on TV. He and Rhaenyra had sex once, and he really thought she was going to give up the entire crown for a one-night bonk. Yeah, he was coerced into it, but he could have said no at any point. She didn't force him to betray his knighthood. Secondly, he went and gassed her up to Alicent with basically no hesitation. I don't know what that's maybe I typoed that copying over. Then he continues to act like a sulky, moody child throughout the rest of the episode, beats another man to death, and then tries to kill himself. I looked up the rest of the character on A Song of Ice and Fire wiki, and don't do this, listeners, unless you want to be spoiled. Yes, of course.
Yeah.
And because I couldn't believe it took just one episode for me to dislike a character that I really liked. Do you, Jim and Aaron, thinks his actions are justified? Justified? Oh, fuck no.
Of course. Yeah.
No. Can I understand why a person would act this way with his upbringing and his position and, you know, what he knew about Rhaenyra and how he thought this was her first time? Even though it's like, and you know, you run that through like a system of enforced patriarchal values. Yes. But is it justified? No, not at all.
Oh, of course not.
This is no way to comport yourself.
Right. This is not leal. This is in no way leal.
It is the opposite of leal.
Yeah. Here's the other thing that I try and remember is there are a lot of time jumps, and we saw them being very close with each other years ago in terms of showtime. So they've spent years. He spent years in her service. So
alone, spending the night together, like they camped out under the stars.
Very close relationship. This is
intimate and everything, but
we
sexual.
Slept once together on some random night that was like, oh, I barely know this little girl. No, they're probably the best of friends at least. And so he assumes like this is the night. This is the night where the relationship here finally changes, right?
Yeah. And I think that that's the thing. If you go back and watch that scene in episode 4 where he's slowly taking off armor and he's really looking, you know, he's really looking at that white cloak. Like, this is a big deal from him. We already talked about the problematic aspect of, you know, that Rhaenyra is in a very real position of power over him. And like, how much power does he have to say no? Mm-hmm. But, you know, he's been with Rhaenyra since the time she was like 14, 15. He probably knows that she hasn't been fucking around, and that she's, you know, like, they have had this close relationship and she's choosing him. And I think he thought it meant something. And what he doesn't understand is that Daemon's just like, you know, have you ever tried just kind of fucking swinging, niece? Have you ever just tried, like, you know, going to a key party or some shit like that? Yeah. And she's got a completely different, and already based on the Targaryens have a very completely different way of the way they view sexuality and things like that, too. You know, they marry brother, sister. They have multiple wives sometimes. They don't truck with the faith of the Seven in totality. So, like, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot. I just think they viewed things very differently. Which brings us to the next point smoothly. Mike says, canonically, the Dornish are an extremely horny people. Mm. You'll recall Prince Oberyn and his paramour and his waxing poetic about the Dornish views on sexuality and gender. Lest I be accused of painting an entire race with a broad brush, I'm only basing this on what I've seen and read about them. Of all the children that the gods created, it turns out Oberyn was the black sheep. Like, the Dorne didn't pretty much know. The Dorne, I think, is safe to say their sexual mores are a little bit more relaxed. Of all the children of the gods created on Planetos, the Dornish famously throw their affection around freely and wildly. There's no shame of being a bastard in Dorne, for example. All this leads me to question Sir Criston Cole's bona fides as a Dornishman. Let me get this straight. Sir Criston is offered the unofficial position of Her Majesty's fuckboy. Not only does he turn it down, he becomes suicidal over it. Did Rhaenyra make the fatal mistake of boning down the one Dornish prude? I don't know, man. Seems kind of suspect to me. Oh, boy. Where do you start? First of all,
he's the only Dornish Kingsguard I've ever seen.
Okay, where to begin? First of all, there's no person or group of people that's like a monolith. Like, you can make some broad generalizations about certain cultures and people and where they're from and what they think, but like, there's always going to be, as you say, the prudish Dornishman. There's always going to be the, you know, wildly horny and irresponsible first Northernman. But also, I think that Sir Criston is culturally Westerosi. I mean, he's not Dornish. Okay. He was raised in a castle in the Reach, and he's been at war and killing Dornishmen. It's kind of like Worf in the Next Generation. Like, he's definitely a Klingon, but as he meets other Klingons from the Klingon Empire, he realizes he's not really like a Klingon. In some ways he's more Klingon than Klingon. In other ways, he completely misses subtle nuances of their culture and what they believe, because he's only seen that at a remove and from afar. So even if you said that there's like some kind of genetic disposition to be horny in Dornishmen, which I kind of reject. Culturally, he's not a Dornishman.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Let's move on to Brad, which I think, no, there's two more Sir Criston takes. It goes, regarding Sir Criston, I think he's been misread all along. He's a low-born thug who killed his way into being a knight. He broke his vows, confessed because he's stupid, killed an innocent guy because his dumb feelings got hurt, and is only alive because the queen ordered him not to kill himself.
I certainly haven't seen anything that makes me think he's smart. So maybe I agree with this.
This is certainly a valid reading that, like, in any other circumstances, he would never have gotten this. But since, like, there is very low conflict and this is a very low conflict part of the kingdom, and he happened to be living on the only active border of a war zone, and was able to kill, a bunch of Dornish people, that he distinguished himself. That's the only reason that he got, like, the Rhaenyra's attention. Mm-hmm. That he actually had combat experience. So, like, I don't know if he's a low, and he's also lowborn, but, like, lowborn thug, I don't know. That might be painting with too broad a brush, but, like, I can see this take for sure.
Yeah, I don't see anything to contradict it, necessarily.
Bethany says, closing out her Sir Christian Cole Chronicles. I wanted to write about and defend Sir Christian Cole a bit. The fandom seems to be giving him lots of hate, and he deserves it for his violence against Joffrey. But there's a boy. There's a sentence you don't hear much in Game of Thrones history. He deserves the hate for his violence against Joffrey. Lonmouth. But there's a reason the White Cloaks take vows of celibacy, and it's not just a puritanical sexual purity thing. It's because they have intimate access to the royal family, and the royals have to trust them not to exploit that access. We've seen what happens when a member of the Kingsguard sleeps with the queen. The realm goes to war. Need we all rewatch Game of Thrones season one? The princess must remain chaste and faithful to her husband because the consequences of having an illegitimate child are war and death. This is not the world we live in, thank goodness, but there are stakes for the royal family in Westeros. Even the suspicion of illegitimacy can spell disaster. I mean, what's even the efficacy of Plan T? Like 90% effective? Would you gamble the safety of the realm on tea? Hilariously, I do think you're supposed to understand, like, moon tea is, like, if it's properly brewed by a maester, is, like, yeah, super effective and 100%. Relatively safe. Yeah.
Yeah.
At least that's, I think, its reputation from the book.
So I agree. You don't want your Kingsguard getting sexually involved with the people that they're guarding. Here's my suggestion in that case. Just preemptively geld them. Let's just say, okay, you take your
go
oath.
The Unsullied, yeah.
Uh-huh. You get cut, and now you can be Kingsguard.
You know, you could make that you could make the argument that, like, well, what do you even need it for? You're not right. Going to pass on titles or lands. You can't mm-hmm. marry. You can't have sex. This is just, I don't know. There's something to the temptation, like, because you also, like, you know, why did God put the knowledge sure. of good and bad in the garden, right? You know, because otherwise, yeah. how can mankind have free will?
Has never made much sense to me. But okay,
right. Right.
Yeah, but you're right.
I know I like to hideously tempt my children with forbidden uh-huh. fruit. That's how the oh, only yeah. way I know they're loyal to me.
I like the cookie jar open with a little fan blowing the smell of
yeah,
cookies.
Wafting the freshly baked chocolate chip cookies uh-huh. and just I'm waiting to, like, for when and with not just punishment but eternal punishment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I cook a 4-course meal that takes hours and hours to prepare and tell them you can have the cookies when dinner is ready.
Yeah.
I think, like, oaths are made to be broken, right? Like, if you have to say to someone, hey, I want you to take an oath,
uh-huh.
the only outcome there is that they break it. That's the only outcome.
Man, that seems like a very modern way to look at it, though, because, like, if you live in a culture, this condition where breaking an oath is, like, this monumental
oh, I know.
Taboo,
I'm kidding.
That's like saying, fucking your sister is just fucking your sister, right? Like, there's a huge fucking taboo against it, and people are going to think you're a crazy person that can't be trusted in society because you can't mm-hmm. break one of our few sacred, you know, the sacred restrictions on that kind of stuff. Like, I think we live in a, oh, God damn, we manifestly live in a society where no one gives a shit about their word and any kind of concept of, we say we do,
oh, yeah,
but we
totally.
Certainly don't value it. We certainly don't value it.
Yeah, I state it ironically when I say rules are there to be broken. They're mm-hmm. clearly not. They're there to be followed.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't think that, like, taking an oath is the end all be all. Whereas, like, gelding somebody, you're at worst guaranteeing that they can't have children with the royalty that they're protecting.
I think I had that conversation would go. That's like a secret that the Kingsguard keep as you get gelded. They're like, okay, you want to take the white cloak? Sure. Okay, we're going to geld you. What the fuck? I'm not going to get gelded. It's like, what? You said you weren't going to have children and you weren't going to have sex.
You already took
so
your oath.
So, like,
what's
the problem here? Sounds to me like we got a fucker over here. We uh-huh. got someone who thinks he's going to fuck as the Kingsguard. Geld him, because that's the punishment for doing that, too. You don't have to
get not being, what needs to be
he's
gelded.
Getting gelded. It's a logic trap, right? And if you don't want to be yeah. gelded, it's prima facie evidence of that you want to fuck around.
Yeah. Makes sense.
So, gosh, Bethany, let's get back to Beth. She's been waiting patiently in the corner while we do our jackassery. The moment that got me in the scene is where he asks her to run away with her, and she has this immediate refusal. You think I'd choose infamy in exchange for a bushel of oranges or a ship to a shy? No, princess, he thought you might choose him. It's naive, yes, and tragically mistaken, but I see how he got there. He assumes the princess would not risk war and destruction for mere pleasure. He didn't know he'd just been revved up by her uncle at the brothel. And that's the point I was making 10, 15 minutes ago, that, yeah, like, he thought this meant something, and this was just her first step into probably a lifetime of pleasure seeking.
Jesus and Christ, man, what a... that's not a step. That's the giant leap. That's the fucking deep end.
Yeah. Does it make sense for a person to, like, grow up one way and then one person bops onto the scene and's like, actually, no, you can do whatever you want. And that person just leaps into that world of possibility? I guess lots of teenagers do.
I was going to say, at that age? Yeah.
I've seen Requiem for a Dream. things get dark and turn on a dime. Mm-hmm. Kristen's getting a lot of flack for his naive and ridiculous proposal, and that's fine, sure. But I'd like to point out that Rhaenyra makes a pretty damn ridiculous proposal to Daemon to kidnap her from her own wedding and marry her on Dragonstone. If you want me, show some courage and take me. Oh, yeah. Like,
this is just provocation. This isn't... She's not serious about that.
I'm not so sure. I don't think she's serious about... him cutting a swath through the Kingsguard and, like, literally, but kind of like, hey, if you wanted me, I've been here this whole time. You should have, like, fought harder for me. And I don't know that she's privy to the ass kicking he got in the throne room. I don't know if, like, she knows all the ins and outs of the stuff, but I think her point's well taken, is that condemning Sir Criston Cole does not let Rhaenyra off the hook for her bullshit that she's doing, you know? Oh, no. And again, I can understand where she's coming from, and I can understand the things that she's doing, but, like, a lot of this stuff is, yeah, I certainly wouldn't condone the behavior she's depicted doing. Sir Criston, unfortunately, was just totally wrong about what story he's in. He's ashamed, jilted and hurt, angry, despairing, and afraid for his life. He could be castrated or killed. Then he stands guard at the wedding of his ex-lover boss, who also happens to be clearly flirting with her uncle, trying to keep it together. Meanwhile, he is alarmed that this random friend of the groom somehow knows the most explosive secret of his life. He must have felt so exposed, ashamed, and unsafe. Yeah, like I said, I understand where he gets there. Totally. And there's a reason, you know, it's considered a bad idea to shit where you eat. It's just, you don't know what's going to happen, and you're really... injecting a lot of emotional sriracha into the situation. There's a lot of spice and opportunity for things to go wrong. Okay, we're closing the Sir Criston Chronicles, I think, if I did my organization right. Jude is up next, and she says, I've heard a lot of praise for this episode, but I personally didn't like the directing. The blocking felt awkward, and the characters were doing uncharacteristic things in multiple scenes. Most notable is the final wedding dinner scene, where I don't believe any of the characters would be so brazenly and openly doing things they shouldn't be doing. Joffrey flirting with Laenor, Daemon and Rhaenyra, Joffrey and Kristen, etc. It totally took me out of the moment because it felt like a director trying to make a point rather than watching the characters interacting in a natural way. I'm surprised to hear so much praise for this scene, since I found it uncomfortable and unrealistic. Was this intentional? Are we supposed to understand that the characters are getting sloppy and brazen with their behavior?
Some of them. Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, Rhaenyra and Daemon? Absolutely. I don't want to try and talk anybody out of their opinion on a scene, but I personally loved it. I liked the sloppiness. It felt real to me in a way that was compelling.
Yeah, and again, there's nothing to show that makes me think these people are political geniuses.
Sure.
You know, it'd be one thing if they had depicted Rhaenyra as one who carefully thinks about everything that she does and thinks about it three different chess moves ahead, and the Daemon's the same way. But they told me the opposite. They told me that these people are crazy, impetuous, passionate, not, you know, to the point of
risking their own lives. Like, yes. Daemon literally was ready to die just to not be proven wrong by his brother.
Yeah, no, they take insane risks, and they say things without thinking about it. Like, think about Rhaenyra, you know, shitting on Lady Redwine for eating cakes when her husband's providing the second largest fleet to the... Like, there's...
saying lots stupid stuff around Alicent, yeah.
Lots of thoughtless things being... But very human mistakes, and I think that... I think that what Daemon said to her about, like, we can do whatever we want, and we're Targaryen, like, Viserys understands that that's stupid. You know, like, you literally, just because I'm the king and we're Targaryens doesn't literally mean we can do whatever we want. But I think Daemon's immature enough and Rhaenyra is literally immature enough that they think that that's possible.
Especially
and maybe
Daemon,
they think
because he doesn't have much to lose. Right. Like, he's not the heir. He's not the king. True. He's never going to be. He's always gonna
he's
be
not afraid to
son.
Die.
Yeah.
He's
he
just
even
not afraid to
life.
Die. Yeah. He would rather die than get stuck as this shitty second son position he's in.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I think it's like a lot of I'm getting that there's a lot of type A 4.0 GPA always turn their homework type kids in the feedback saying, I don't understand why these crazy people are acting crazy. They're just reckless and not thoughtful in a way that maybe you have a hard time conceiving of. And I get it like that.
Sure, sure.
That I wonder what I would think if I watched the first few seasons of Walking Dead, because I really thought about how crazy and dumb and stupid some of these people were. But as I've gotten older and I've seen how crazy, dumb and stupid people can be in certain situations, like, I don't know, even the zombie apocalypse wises some people up. But yeah, sloppy and brazen. I think that's going to be the new house words for whatever cadet branch that the Targaryens Daemon ends up launching here. Matt from Briston says, I've been watching MMA for 15 years and never has a man turned another man's face into a pure mush by using fists alone. Am I supposed to understand that Christian somehow used his armor to pummel Joffrey, or is he just incredibly strong, perhaps second only to Harwin? Or is this to showrunners, or is it just to showrunners or fans of The Boys and want to shock us with a similar aesthetic?
Well, I mean, come on. The Boys didn't invent ultraviolence. Game of Thrones has plenty of that in its history.
Yeah, I mean, this is like Fight Club, you know, like this is destroying something beautiful.
Oh, yeah. No, I think it's definitely there for shock value. I don't know if he literally could have done this to a human skull, but yeah, he's given Harwin a run for his money for sure.
The thing about MMA that you got to realize is whenever a fighter becomes unable to defend themselves, there's always a large gentleman there to spread, put, you know, to shoot in there and put himself between the assailants to keep the violence from going beyond, you know, to this level. But, and you also look at the skull and like they all wear gloves. The skull has these like orbital processes that are extremely delicate. You know, like you break those, you lose a lot of the shape of your face. And I also noticed that, like, while Sir Christian Cole wasn't wearing like heavy gauntlets, he did have these greaves that seemed like they kind of like went to cover over his like knuckle area. And they might have acted like steel brass knuckles as he's pounding this guy's face. And, you know, Christian could have also broken every bone in his hand. But I think it's possible for a strong, and I think Sir Christian Cole is also pretty strong. You know, he bested every other knight in this tournament. I think it's possible for a man to beat another man's face into this kind of shape. You would probably break a lot of hands in your a lot of bones in your hand, but yeah, once you start shattering those, you know, it's one thing if he's beating in the top of his head, cause that's pretty thick bone or the jaw process, but like you can break a guy's jaw and cave in like that whole sinus area. That's just all honeycomb lightly built structure. So yeah, once I think it's possible anyway.
Okay.
I can't say that I've seen it either because I live in a civilized, polite society. But
yeah, but it is meant to be gruesome too. Let's not kid around whether it's possible or not. They were like, we need to make this extremely gruesome.
Yeah.
So you'll be angry at Kristen, right? Like,
yeah.
So you won't sympathize with him.
Yeah, like this same crowd that cheers lustily at people dying in the tournament, not at blood splat. Like you can see like around like everyone's kind of sickened and like this is fucked up like by highborn, entertained by gladiatorial combat, you know, great house standards. This
might
is
just be because
up.
It's happening in their great hall
to one of their own. Yeah. Unprovoked. Yeah.
Be like, oh, that's horrible. I don't know.
I guess all that tourney shit's happening to their own, too. Those are the sons and daughters of the high lords and ladies, and sometimes the high lords themselves.
But that's in an appropriate setting, right? You expect violence at a tournament.
That's true. Like, you go to a boxing match.
At a wedding feast.
Yeah, if you go to a boxing match, nobody's like, oh my God, there's people striking each other. Yeah,
why doesn't someone stop this, right?
Yeah, whereas you go to, you know, orchestral reciting, it's... yeah. Someone taking down the conductor and giving him the elbows is considered not good. Deb, do you think Viserys maybe has a false sense of security about his succession? At the start of the show with Alicent and Rhaenyra being such good friends, maybe he anticipated Alicent would stay a loyal supporter of his daughter, even if she went in to have her own sons with him. Like, Alicent would be the safest option because at the time he anticipated they would both stay loyal to each other and possibly have an even stronger bond. Whereas if he had taken someone else as his wife, they may have been more ambitious to put their own children on the throne ahead of Rhaenyra. You know, this is where I wish there was another scene where I couldn't kind of understood the calculus because, but this is again where they're doing a very fire and blood thing. Why did Viserys marry Alicent? Was it because she was this attractive teenage girl who paid him a lot of attention and flattered him? Is because he did this mental calculation about, well, my daughter and her are good friends, so this will be a less of a blow than if I take some rando, and also she's going to be more or less likely to want to dispute the succession. Is it because Otto or like hard pressed him to do it? Is it because dot dot dot? And we just don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I have my opinions. I think he got taken in by Alicent.
And now Viserys is aware of that at some level or suspects it, because one of the things he said as he's throwing Otto out of the Red Keep is like, oh, and don't think I haven't thought about the timing of your daughter coming into my comfort and what a distraction that was. So whatever it was at the beginning, now he's got a few more wrinkles of understanding about it.
Totally.
There's still lots of hot D to talk about. We'll be back right after the break. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. And now, back to Hot D. Okay, Gretel B says, I was just wondering how you think Hot D will fare with the big cast turnover that's coming up. Game of Thrones lost some significant players in the first season, but it was also established a dozen core actors for the next 10 years. And Hot D, Millie Alcock, and Emily Carey will be saying their goodbyes. Patty Considine is on the way out. Most of the upcoming characters will be portrayed by child and adult actors, not having a lot of time to bond or connect with a single performer. The story and time jumps are incredibly ambitious, but I'm wondering how the revolving cast will affect the show.
I think it'll be okay. I think they've done a pretty good job casting So the characters sort of look like the younger versions of themselves when they get older. And I think that's going to go a long way to letting you identify with the character you either liked or hated when they were younger.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it'll be okay. I'm not, let's just say I'm not, necessarily dreading like Emma Darcy replacing Millie Alcock. I love Millie Alcock. I think she's great.
Uh-huh.
But I think the work she's done here has set a foundation for what Darcy's going to do. And I'm looking forward to that, kind of. Because then right. we get into the point of the show where we're going to be with those characters for a long time. I'm looking at this as sort of like table setting, and they're doing a great job of it. And then the feast is to come with the adult versions of these characters.
Right. Yeah, and that's something we remarked about when we saw Yellow Jackets last season, which is like half told from the perspective of these teenage girls. And then you flash forward like 15, 20 years and you're dealing with their middle-aged counterparts. Mm-hmm. And that is shocking how well that worked, because
they did a really good job casting.
And then yeah. those actors hung out together and collaborated on how we can come up with physical quirks. And I thought yeah. I saw a lot of Millie Alcock giving Emma Darcy type of looks and stuff, like the how she held her face and kind of purses her lips and narrows her eyes. Like I've seen from the trailers, I think you're going to see that they probably spent a lot of time together talking about the nuances of like, you know, how is this person going to chew on their fingernails this way? And how is a person like when we feel threatened or when we feel secure, well, how do we act? And it's you're not like falling in love with a character an actor so much as the character. Mm-hmm. And I trust, unless this is going to turn into a train wreck, that you're going to have a high degree of continuity. Like when Emma Darcy yeah. steps onto the screen, you're not going to be like, well, this is an entirely new person. You're going to be like, this is Rhaenyra mm-hmm. stepping forward 10, 15 years into the future and seamlessly portraying this continuity of a single individual being. And if they can't do that, then they're in trouble. But like, I don't think yeah. it's like every other thing. It's like you can do whatever you want in filmmaking and art. You just have to do it good.
Right. It's all about execution.
Yeah.
Here's a question for you. Do you think it would be smart of them to make the handoff here to the older actors before the end of the season? Because we've talked about, like, are they going to keep with these younger actors till the end of the season and then make the change and we'll jump ahead? Or is that going to feel too disjointed? Is that going to not give you that continuity that you want between characters?
Doing what? Like if they do it,
like if they wait until the end of the season and then next season they come back and say, okay, all the characters are older and we've jumped ahead, you know, another 10 years or whatever.
I mean, I've seen trailers to the show. So I think that would have been the riskiest play if you actually win a whole season. I do wonder if they're if you're going to just come back in this episode and they'll just be the adult actors, or they're going to do like that Matt Damon Saving Private Ryan where they just an old man dissolves into a younger man. And
yeah, like a mid episode kind of thing.
Yeah,
that would be the least risky play, right? Like literally show this person when they're young and then juxtapose that with them being old and we will make the connection without a doubt. But
yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's certainly something to be worried about because it's an unknown. Like we like what we're seeing now. This has been, mm-hmm. I think, an unqualified success. I think this is better than most of us thought it would be or hoped it would be.
Yeah.
And now we're having this. But like you could say this, you know, you even say it in yourself. It's like Sean Bean and who's Bobby Baratheon? I can't ever remember that guy's name. There were a lot of like big names that we kind of clung to. There were primary motivating forces of Game of Thrones, and they get off the fucking stage by the end of that season in pretty spectacular fashion. So,
yeah.
And you're right. They had a whole slew. But like that's the other thing is like we have shockingly few of the players of the upcoming events. Mark Addy. Mark Addy has played the older Bobby B, the breastplate stretch needing Bobby B.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't probably even gotten half of the characters that are going to be big players in this upcoming Dance of Dragons. So like there's tons more people to love and hate to come. And I would be shocked if they fucked this up, because from the trailers I've seen, it looks like the people involved are doing a really good job of having that character continuity. But we'll see.
I'll say it's been a little weird to see Lena and Lenor grow so much so rapidly, whereas Rhaenyra and Allison have basically looked exactly the same the entire time. I don't think they did enough to like age down or age up those two actors.
Yeah, but I feel like puberty is a hell of a drug.
Entirely. Oh, no, I agree. Like, yeah, being you 12 had prepubescent versus
postpubescent. Yeah, 14 to 15. I just saw this as I went back to my mom's house and we had all these, like, I went through sorting through all these pictures or family history. And like, I don't think you could I don't know that you can recognize me from like 4, 5, 6, 10, you know, but once you get to like 13, 14, 15, like, I feel like I'm recognizably. I got a beard now and I've lost a lot of hair, but like, you can definitely see the facial structure is settling into its shape. And yeah, that when that testosterone and estrogen starts flooding through you.
Here's the mistake I think they actually made, like, legitimately, really, it's a mistake, is Lena. I think they made her look way too young when she was being considered
and then
for
way
marriage.
Too old now.
And now she looked like she was 8. Now she looks like she's 16. And Rhaenyra looks identical to how she looked in that same amount of time. I think that's the one actual mistake.
I think that's forgivable because Lena was only in that one scene. And I guess she was in the press box with at the tourney. Like, so like, whereas, boy, if you had three different actors playing Rhaenyra, you might really struggle with, but I don't know.
I think they like should just age down like a 14-year-old or something. It made her actually look 12 instead of 8. She looked so young.
But they wanted that there. They wanted that.
I know,
like, deliberate,
but it's,
like,
I think it's a mistake to
factor.
Now like want her to be a woman full grown, whereas Rhaenyra hasn't changed a tiny bit. So
you could be right. I will say this though. I do think that they have aged up Rhaenyra's look a little bit. She does look like an older teen, and especially the way they act. Like, they used to act a lot more girlish.
Sure.
And I think they've done a good job of, like, with the dress and costuming, making it seem like they were 14 and now they're like 18 going on 19. But
yeah, I suppose.
Walker of Dragons says, just listen to your Insta Take in episode 5. I love how the show is portraying events as they actually happened, or so the showrunner says. It brings up how biased and inaccurate historical accounts tend to be, depending on who wrote them. Blood and Fire is written by maesters in the pay of Targaryen, so of course incidents like Ser Criston beating a man to death are going to be either covered up or arranged because everyone knows that he remained in Kingsguard long after these events. If he'd actually been beating someone to death for no apparent reason without royal intervention, of course he'd be done. How long did it take for the general public to learn about JFK's dalliances or Thomas Jefferson's quote-unquote other children? This is a good point and something that I think George Martin mentioned in the last week or two, something about that one of these maesters' viewpoints is intentionally of like the primary source. There's like 3 or 4 or 5, 6 different primary sources cited in this era of Fire and Blood. We talk about Mushroom. We talk about Septon, Eustace. We talk about, I forget the maester, but like he said that one of these people are probably suspect because they are either extremely pro Rhaenyra and extremely pro Alicent. And because of the loyalties that they had. And you've got to, I mean, that's one of the bitches about history, man, is it's written by the winners. And you really have to go cast your eyes over tons of primary sources to even get an understanding of the history. When we're talking about thousands of years ago, you might only have one primary source.
Yeah, or zero.
Or, yeah, so.
All you have is second-hand accounts.
Walker Dragons continues, my upcoming curiosity is whether the Grand Maester is poisoning Viserys. I tend to think he is, either knowingly or not. Then because of this new tension about succession, there's a concerted effort to keep Viserys alive and functional until it could be sorted out. What do you think about that? The Grand Maester poisoning Viserys. And what do you think the likelihood is of being an active versus maybe negligent kind of thing?
I don't know. It doesn't take like plotting nefarious plots for me to think that an older maester might disregard the experiments of a younger maester. And that's really the only thing I've seen that would indicate he's not doing everything he can to help. So I don't have any indication of that yet. If that's the story they're telling it poorly.
I mean, I think it's there. Like, if they want to tell that story, all the pieces are there for them to put together later. But
sure.
Like,
they could tell that story.
But... supposition, extreme supposition right now.
Yeah.
Walker of Dragons continues. You know, when the show was first announced, I thought Targaryens, really boring, or at least not all that intriguing. Yeah, it's a fucked up royal family. But the writing and acting have really brought the story to life in a way that keeps me coming back weekly. I also really like the female director of these last two episodes and how she handles the intimate scenes. I don't feel like a 12-year-old after watching two men kissing. Thanks for depicting intimacy without exploitation. Nothing like a little dancing through, though, to ramp up the tension. Yeah, I think Claire Kilner has done a really good job these last two episodes. And, of course, she gets the penultimate one at the end of the season, too.
Nice.
And just like there's a couple of women that have been, because for a long time it was like, oh, it's Michelle McLaren. She was always person that, you know, that really good action director. And, you know, she kept on showing up on all my favorite shows. Another one to keep an eye on is Jennifer Getzinger. She is the one, in my opinion, that saved season three of Westworld because, oh, my God, no one knew how to fucking shoot action until she showed up and showed people how it did. And she's been doing work on other shows. I mean, like, she did like three episodes of Outer Range this year. Is that sci-fi kind of cowboy mashup that I heard was really good, but I haven't seen.
No.
So, yeah, I think Ms. Kilner is doing fantastic work, and I'm looking forward to see what she does with the, you know, Episode 9's Game of Thrones projects tend to get crazy.
They do.
Tend to have some big wild swings.
I'm glad Sapochnik is not just like hogging up all the directing glory, right? Be the one season showrunner and...
Yeah.
And then...
Peace out.
Yeah, let other people direct.
Seawell says, the panning shot over the food that was spoiling on the table reminded me of the story the High Sparrow told Marjorie about how he put all the effort into making rich people's shoes just so he could party with his friends, only to wake up the next day to see how disgusting everything was after the liquor and the perfume had worn off, how repulsive their bodies looked bare, that they were all in a stupor and the food had already turned when he saw the true form of it all. Yeah, that's I instantly remembered that monologue once you mentioned it, but it did give that flavor of like, look at these people prancing and vorting, thinking they're at the pinnacle of human existence. And now look at this excess and rot and the blood and decay.
Yeah, totally.
I went Miss Havisham. You went High Sparrow. Only Jim got only one of those references. Christopher says, guys, great job as always, but I have one thing to point out to you. Everyone keeps talking about mushroom, 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 but have you noticed the name of the maester who assists the Grand Maester? He's none other than Maester Orwell, one of the main sources for Fire and Blood. Extremely interesting. I did not know that. He is the younger one
who suggested the new poultice?
Yeah, he's one of the primary sources that Maester Gildane, who is the compiler of Fire and Blood, cites for the Dance of the Dragons era. So we'll see if he becomes a big part later on. I would love to meet Septon Eustace. I would love to meet Mushroom because like I'd like to get an idea over what their loyalties are, how much of a bullshitter. I mean, Mushroom's a pretty big bullshitter. like how prudish, like I there's a lot of things like you can assume that Septon Eustace is the more of a prudent one that's going to find a way that even if there's a tale that's more of a mushroom tale, he's going to very, you know, keep it couched in academic language and not dwell on the massive members and all, you know, the pleasuring with their mouths and things like the mushroom loves to get into. So I would love to meet more of these people, and I'm glad that one of them has already shown up. So thanks for pointing that out, Christopher. Raphael says, was it me or did it get extremely dark leading up to and immediately after the fight in the feast scene of House of the Dragon? I just did a rewatch. I noticed it the first time, but this time it was so dark I had a hard time telling what was happening. The first time I watched it was with the lights off and it was bad, but with the lights on today, as I was typing away on my computer, it got insanely dark. It almost reminded me of The Long Night, but I have a much better TV now. So what gives?
I didn't.
It's a dark scene.
Being too dark, but yeah, it definitely got dark.
I tend to keep my living room dimmed with some tasteful backlighting when I'm watching stuff because I think that's, you know, we can bitch and moan about it, but like they kind of intend this to be watched cinematically. I don't think you're supposed to watch this with like all your windows open at high noon. you know, with all your lamps going and all that. Like, it's supposed to be in kind of a darkened room with a well-adjusted television. Yeah. But I don't have the world's greatest television. It's a decent, you know, it's not OLED. It's what is the LED?
Okay.
So it gets decent blacks and all that stuff. But like, and after, because Jim came over to watch the pilot and he's like, Jesus Christ, this is washed out. And it wounded me. So I actually in the week after that, I went and got some reference stuff and I actually tried to get my television more dialed in. And okay. With the room lights off on Sunday night, it looked perfect. Like it's that cool thing where, you know, and that's the other thing. It's like when you play video games, I got that slider. It's like, you know, here's a picture of a wolf. Adjust the slider until you can just barely see the wolf. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people to play those games where the wolf looks like it's like day glow white. And some people like to play it where you can't even really see the wolf because they like getting the jump scares and all that kind of stuff. I wish they did that for prestige stuff. It would be cool if they start each episode of a prestige television with like the logo of the show and you're supposed to adjust it to where you can bear if you want the full intended experience. But I'm getting to the point to where like when I saw it Sunday night, I thought it was perfect. Like it intentionally was dim and low light, but I had no trouble making out the textures of people's clothes, the detail, their expression on her face. When I watched it again on Tuesday, on Tuesday morning, it was pretty bright outside. But still, I didn't think it was too dark, but it's on that border.
Yeah. It's tough for me to say, cause I watch it in the basement of my house. So it's,
and you do have an OLED too,
off.
Right?
I do. Yeah. Have,
and that's like the current, like, I think that's the best if you want like really accurate
dark
black
blacks,
levels. And,
yeah. Like pure blacks. Yeah. So I've got a decent TV and yeah, my environment for watching is very ideal, I would say.
The other thing is like, man, I know when we watched, I think season 7 and season 8 of Game of Thrones, they were on a cable set top box that was maybe doing 720 BS resolution. And that makes a huge difference. If you're watching a muddy transfer, then you're fucked. So I don't know if you're watching like 4K on HBO or at least like a 1080p mm-hmm. stream. But like as your resolution goes down and as that degrades, yeah, that shit can look muddy real fast. Mm-hmm. Dallas in Nashville says, is it just me or are dragon eggs much smaller than they should be? If you think about the size of a dragon and how little the dragon eggs are, it's the equivalent of a chicken laying the eggs the size of pea gravel. I feel like dragon eggs should be the size of a yoga ball, if not bigger, depending on the size of the dragon laying it. Do you think it's a matter of the showrunners trying to make eggs as convenient as possible to appear and be moved from one place or another? Maybe they're putting more time and effort into the ornateness of the shell as opposed to what its real size should be. Thoughts on the size of dragon eggs, Jim?
I'd never considered it until this point. I feel like there are animals that in our real world that are surprisingly big given the size of their eggs, but I'm struggling. Like an ostrich egg is pretty big, but
it's pretty big, but I don't think it's in proportion to a chicken. And like a kiwi lays a egg like roughly the size of its whole fucking body. And so look at dinosaur eggs. Like a Tyrannosaurus, I just looked it up. The average egg size in a clutch of Tyrannosaurus eggs is 17 inches long. So it's just about the size of your forearm. Wow.
Okay.
That's about the size of a dragon egg on Game of Thrones. Is a Tyrannosaurus shitting out too small of an egg?
I look at Diplodocus's. So I don't know.
Okay, look at this. Diplodocus. So this is one of the largest. This is a dinosaur at fully grown is 80 feet long. Its egg is roughly the size of a grapefruit. So even smaller than the T-Rex. Jeez. So like I think even if you look at real life inspiration, I don't have too big a problem with these dragon eggs.
Okay.
Abby says, you mentioned a Viserys's genuine prophecy related concerns about Rhaenyra keeping her name to have a Targaryen on the throne. I think that's a very generous take because he didn't say anything along these lines. And even if he couldn't tell Corlys about all the prophecies, there could have been a follow-up with him and Rhaenyra where he assures her that this precaution has been implemented. Or he could have told Corlys something more than, bruh, you really want to end tradition just because she's a girl? I just disagree. Like, he's not going to tell Corlys anything about this prophecy.
Of course.
Especially when, you know, the prestige of it is something that like Corlys would believe. And the other thing is, like, as I talked about before, I don't think he's really treating Rhaenyra as a true peer. Like, he only brings up this prophecy when A, he's trying to hastily justify why he made her the heir, when really it's just to shine on Daemon. And B, when he's disappointed in her and he's trying to make her appreciate the seriousness of what it's like to be a Targaryen leader. Absent those, it's like we never see him mentoring and tutoring her. So why the fuck would he come back and be like, oh, hey, just in case you're worried that you might have to take this dude's name or fuck up the Targaryen prophecy, I've got that handled. I just don't think it would even occur to him to talk about that.
So he doesn't really give a shit about the prophecy. You know, he goes on about it when it suits him, but when he's making decisions, he doesn't consider that strictly.
I don't know. My mom give a shit about cleaning the house on the weekends.
Oh, God.
I do think it's like, no, I think that's a very useful, like, hey, young people, listen up. You want to cut through the bullshit of the world? Pay less attention to what people say and pay more attention to what people do. That's going to save you a lot of heartache. That's going to cut through a lot of loyalty games that they'll play at work and in your personal life. Because like words are wind, as George Martin likes to say. What people do, that shows you what people really care about. So yeah, that metric, Viserys does not care about the prophecy. And I'll go to say, I don't think any of these fucking Targaryens. A close reading of their shit reveals that none of them really give a shit about the prophecy.
Gotcha. I would also say, like, Corlys is making a huge ask here. You know, this is not like a mundane thing that it's like a formality they've got to get through. This is like, this is against tradition entirely.
Oh, yeah. I think that they definitely sold that, like, he's on the ragged edge of pissing the king off.
It is the tradition, but he's like enforcing it, and he wants to enforce it in a way that is offensive to the king and the king's intentions.
Right.
So like he doesn't have to invoke, oh, well, I have a special prophecy that says Targaryens need to sit on the throne. He just has to invoke, you shit. Are you really trying to usurp in name the authority of my appointed heir? Get fucked.
Yeah. You want to end the Targaryen dynasty after 100 years? I don't think so. Right. Yeah. There's tradition and then there's tradition, you know?
Yeah.
Abby says, I love Rhaenyra and Laenor doing what only could be called the dance of dragons at their wedding. Very on brand, while also being a nod to things to come. Yeah. I mean, it's literally a dance of dragons, I guess. And it was such a goofy, stilted little Westerosi line dance.
I liked it. I especially like the flapping arm thing that they're doing.
Yeah, that's why I never read. But yeah, they were doing the dance of the dragons. Mm-hmm. It's no boot scooting boogie. I'm going to tell you that much.
Mm-hmm. No electric slide.
Also, while Sir Smooches only gets to appear in one episode, he made a lasting impact by uttering the 5-star line. The man is fully cunt struck. Truly, there are no small parts. There's been more than once this week that I have done my very best AC/DC impression and been like, you've been counterstruck. It's fun. It's a fun turn of phrase. Uh-huh. We owe a debt of comedy gratitude to the Knight of Kisses for coming up with that one. Red Wheelbarrow says, I was watching episode one and surprised at how much Lionel Strong actually spoke. In the second council meeting, right after the heir for a day funeral, Otto recommends going away from Daemon and making Viserys' daughter the next heir. Lionel Strong immediately jumps in and speaks about how the realm has been at peace for over 100 years, and there'd be no acceptance of a woman on the throne. I think it's 70 years, but your point's taken. Of course, the entire council starts shouting and the king storms out, but Strong made his point clear. Does this show that behind the scenes, the Strong family is not comfortable with the woman on the throne for the sake of the realm? This was glossed over in episode one, and then we see the Strong portrayed as if he just gives it straight to the king without looking for his own interest. But was he perhaps biding his time?
This is what I'm saying. Sending Laris over there to... Lionel, I'm looking at you. I'm watching you, man.
Are you questioning the lealness of this man's service?
Look, he might be doing it for the right reasons, but he's sowing discord amongst the heir to be and the queen. If if he had anything to do with that.
Well, it reminds me of like when politicians talk about their public and private positions. Like, you know, privately, I support this, but like my constituency supports the other thing. And I, you know, I have to support them, blah, blah. Like, I think that like this indicates that personally, Lord Strong doesn't truck with women on the Iron Throne. Well, man, is it that he is against women being on Iron Throne, or is he saying the realm is against it? And right. thus, as your advisor, I have to advise against it. And are those meaningfully different? Because one is you sure. are the status quo, and the other is you're maintaining the status quo so as not to upset the majority. So
yeah,
you're also,
you know, maybe you can justify that by saying, well, there will be war, there will be strife, a lot of people will die, a lot of people will be hurt by this if we try and change the status quo. But
yeah,
you know, it's still a shitty status quo. So
yeah,
I don't know.
But Red Wheelbarrow concurs with you. It says, it makes me believe that Father Strong is working with his son Clubfoot to reach out and offer assistance to Allison, since she already has a male heir that the realm could accept. Boy, I thought Lionel was so leal, it's unreal. But now,
yeah,
seeds of doubt are starting to form.
They're there. I'm just saying, if I'm the king, I could be looking at what is happening here and saying, like, questioning the loyalty of my servants.
Lauren reflects on the two types of feminine power on display.
Let me go back real quick.
Okay.
And to that point, do you think the Viserys is going to be extra skeptical of the things that Strong is doing here, since he's just had to miss one of his hands? Is he going to be looking more closely at the actions of his hand, saying, I need to make sure this next hand is better than the last hand?
Man, I got from this last episode that Viserys thinks that he finally has a hand he can trust. The way he was talking to Lionel in his bedchambers as his arms rotting off. Like, it wasn't like, I need to be more careful. It's more of, yeah. But that's...
Yeah.
And that doesn't say what Strong's true intentions are either, so...
Totally.
Anyway, Lauren wants to reflect on the two types of feminine power on display here in Hot D. Says, you spoke a little about how Fire and Blood did not explicitly say that Rhea Royce died at Daemon's hand, and that the show here, and as in other instances, has quote unquote filled in the gaps. I wonder if Rhea's death is, as it appeared in the show, acts as something as a warning for Rhaenyra. Rhea flatly declines her cousin Sir Gerald's help on the hunt, saying that she prefers to ride alone, leaving her and subsequently her entire house open to Daemon's machinations. Don't we see Rhaenyra doing the same thing? For a long time, she refused marriage. She clearly wants to stand in her own power, both as a woman. Think of how she stands for what she wants with Daemon, Kristen, and Laenor in this episode. And as the heir. But is the realm ready for that? In standing on her own and badly wielding power, will she leave herself vulnerable as Rhea did? You contrast that with Allison's approach to power in this episode. She never says what she wants or claims any authority. She takes more of a traditional approach to feminine power in this world. But we see her as powerful just the same. We see her begin to wield power not by force or will, but through influence over her husband, Sir Criston, and I suspect eventually through her son, Aegon. Man, this reminds me of old school Peggy and Joan from Mad Men, where like Joan was the person who was adept in wielding power within the existing status quo and structure of this corporate America in the 50s and 60s. And Peggy was the one being like, no, fucking damn it, I'm going to go in on my own terms and do it my own way.
Yeah.
And initially, Joan had a lot more success and Peggy had so much shit thrown in her face. But in the end, like, I think Peggy's approach was determined to be the correct one. And Joan eventually, embraced that. I wonder, because that's the thing. It's like the skills you need to excel within an existing system are obviously not the skills you need to dismantle and reform that system.
Sure.
So... You're always going to be more lightning rod doing the reforming and restructuring and dismantling. And I guess it's just timing and historical fate that determines which one is best. You know, there's one safer.
There's always pain. There's always pain that comes with disrupting anything. So,
and there's pain conforming yourself to the existing system too, because you have to buy into some of the bullshit, like probably at a deep internal level.
Which is why I think that Allison's done that. Disrupt unjust and ridiculous status quos, right?
Like, yeah,
there's gonna be pain either way. Let's just get to the good part.
Yeah, which society says oftentimes you first.
Because sure,
it is
absolutely, yeah.
It isn't a fun path to trod.
And the people who, you know, have vested interests in the current system are comfortable. They've set up a system that works for them. They don't want to disrupt it, right? Even if it doesn't work for everybody.
Sumu says, quick take, probably obvious, but I've not heard anyone say if Damon hasn't consummated the marriage, doesn't it make it void? Therefore, won't be entitled to his late wife's inheritance. We didn't talk much about the inheritance of Runestone. We'll have to see how that plays out.
I bet they consummate it. It's just no offspring came from it, right?
Well, so later Rhea says you've come to finally consummate. Is that because like Damon even couldn't get it up that first night? Is it because he couldn't finish?
That's what she says.
Yeah, she says, are you here to consummate? So I don't know what she means by consummate. And also, you have to, the real question is, who in the realm knows they haven't consummated their marriage? Because you're right. An unconsummated marriage, this is something that Tywin made a point to Tyrion again and again and again. You've got to fucking bed the Stark girl, because if you don't, things can get fucked. Mm-hmm. If someone could prove that a marriage was unconsummated, I think in this period of time, it would be seen as invalid and null and void.
Okay. Interesting.
But is Lady Rhea out there running her mouth about how unconsummated their marriage is? Is Damon? It doesn't seem like it.
Yeah. How's Royce going to, I guess I shouldn't say Royce, Gerald going to make that claim?
Mm-hmm. You'd think he would have advanced it too, if he's like, you know, if Damon says, like, I'm going to go inherit your shit. So you're going to inherit shit. You didn't consummate the marriage. How did they get away with not doing a bedding ceremony? Because that was the whole point of the bedding ceremony in medieval societies, as we saw practiced in Game of Thrones, is you carried along and oftentimes watched and actively participated in that first bedding. So, you know, the P went into the V successfully and the deal was done, you know,
which maybe just have a different standard. Maybe the vows could be the standard by which marriages are consummated.
Sure.
Do you have to go watch it, or could you just say, yeah, they're married officially when we marry them officially?
We'll have to
each
see
each and every one of them is what I'm getting at.
They just wanted to watch the deflowering. That's what it is, you know. Russell says Rhea Royce makes a reference to sheep being prettier, which indicates that gossip has escaped the small council. Do you think this is a case of just that, gossip being gossip, like real housewives shit? Or does this indicate that Otto was working a lot harder to undermine Damon?
That could be. Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if Otto's leaking dirty laundry.
Also, are we sure that Damon hasn't been saying this to everybody that asks about Lady Royce? Like, I don't know, this is confined to the small council, him, you know, this bronze bitch and this and that and the other about her.
Could be.
Seems like he's the type of guy who is trying to, you know, again, my read on this was,
I'm sure he's badmouthed his wife to her almost certainly.
Yeah. Cause my takeaway was that this was Damon trying to get ahead of his bad press. Like if Lady Rhea ever said Damon just can't fucking get it up and he's terrible in bed, he's already got the offense. Like, nah, Damon just thinks you're shit. You're gross. You're just one of his ugly veil women.
Right. He'd just challenge whoever to get it up with her because she's so horrible. Yeah.
And unfortunately, I think the realm is going to naturally try to take the testimony of a man, a good looking, wealthy prince over, you know, she's a highborn lady, but not on the scale of three. And even then, like, just man versus woman, I think that the Westeros would probably take the man's word over the woman. So. Some corrections real quick. Dylan says, in the beginning of the main episode, Aeron mentions the Hightowers using a green flame to call their banners New Lore, but it's actually Gurm canon according to Fire and Blood. Here's a line from a chapter in Fire and Blood called Sons of the Dragons, which shouldn't be a spoiler since it predates the House of the Dragon story. It says, atop the Hightower, the green beacon fire turned to baleful green as Lord Martin Hightower called his banners. Yeah,
okay.
I thought it was new lore, and my way to check that is usually I go to the House Hightower wiki article and I scan through it to see. I searched for Green Beacon and I didn't see anything that wasn't referencing this episode. And in the couple minutes I had before I sat down and recorded a podcast, I thought that was due diligence enough. But several people informed me of this, mea culpa. This is established lore that they were leaning into, which is super cool. Sarah says,
"Hey, the other colors. Do they light it up like blue when dinner's ready? Do they light it up like I don't know a certain flavor of pink when
it's like your mood,
a birth,
your mood status on what was that? What was before? What do we have before?
MySpace?
Yes, MySpace.
Oh,
yeah,
Christ, I haven't thought about MySpace in decades.
They burn to blue flame when they're feeling kind of sad."
I haven't thought about MySpace since people are still using MySpace.
Is that like they burn the blue flame when the Lord's feeling like he wants the vague post? He wants his banner lords to be like, "What's wrong, my lord? Is there something wrong? Are you okay?"
Those attention-seeking Hightowers, they're just the worst. Every other week, they're lighting up the blue flame.
You already have a high tower that you set on fire, so everyone from miles around looks at you. Now you got to do this shit. Come on. All right. Sarah says, "Hey, guys, Joffrey Lawnmouth is the Knight of Kisses because the House Lawnmouth symbol is skulls and kisses." This of all the sigils I've seen on House of Thrones or Game of Thrones, this is one of them because it's literally an alternated checkers of like a Rolling Stone style lips and skulls. So,
oh my God, it
right?
is
right. What
the choice
fuck?
Is yours? This can't be real. This is fan fiction.
Skulls or kisses. This is like this is like the offer that Pablo Escobar gave people: lead or silver. I still have more questions. Like,
how does a pair of lips end up as your house sigil?
Yeah. This just punts the question. I got to know who's the original Knight of Kisses. You get the kiss on both cheeks, or you get the mace.
There's still lots of hot D left to talk about. We'll be right back after the break. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, "Hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it."
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is reward unto itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
And now, back to Hot D.
All right. Cyrus says, and this is going to be kind of like our kickoff to our lore section. For the people who have been part of the Song of Ice and Fire tinfoil community, they've surely heard of the theory where Dany may be misremembering the lemon tree in Braavos in the yard of the house with the red door. Theories include that perhaps it was Dorne or somewhere more south than Braavos and Essos. So this is he's referencing like Dany has these dim memories of growing up in the only place she felt truly happy in is this house with a red door and has a lemon tree in the courtyard. And a lot of people are like Braavos is awful high latitude for a citrus tree to grow. Okay. What the fuck is up with that? So in this episode, Laris says, is it Malvale's the fruit? He says a rare broom. Bloom. It's indigenous to Braavos. By all rights, it shouldn't be thriving here. Nature is such a mystery. I take this as Ryan Condal telling us fans that it was Braavos where Dany remembers. Here, Malvels, indigenous to Braavos, are growing and thriving in King's Landing like lemons could be in Braavos, implying that when you have the resources, you can make what is not indigenous thrive when cared for, like the Malvels in King's Landing and lemon trees in the house of the Sea Lord of Braavos. There's even a conspicuous shot of a mural depicting a lemon tree behind Laris in this scene. I love the show. The showrunners took the time to address the Song of Ice and Fire book theory. Ryan Connell's a nerd, and I love it. What do you think? I think this is fun and hilarious, and I don't know if it's Condal put, because like also this could be one of the many instances where George Martin came in and said, hey, I've seen people getting crazy about Dany and her memories of the red door and the lemon tree. Why don't we put a little bit of cold water on that for me, Ryan?
Yeah. You know, if Martin really wants to put some cold water on it, maybe write a fucking book.
You got
a place to do that. You got a platform, dude. Maybe.
Why do that when you personally get paid millions of dollars for executive producing a show based on still unfinished Volume 1 Targaryen history, Fire and Blood?
I don't even have a horse in this race. I'm never going to read the books, but it just feels like a slap in everyone's face. Still.
My face feels slapped. I don't understand the fan. Like I just came up to this. I was talking to one of my colleagues that I felt was shocked at the viciousness to which I attacked Double D's. I don't think it's that vicious. I just say that, like, I thought they owed us a better ending than that. And if they didn't want to take the time and effort, if they're too tired, then they should have handed it off to somebody else. And they're like, oh, how can you say that? They worked so hard. They did. I don't think any evidence that Double D's worked hard for shit the last 2 years. I think the craftsmen, the tradespeople, the below the lines people and the actors acted their asses off. I don't know about those two. And, you know, I don't know. I don't think there's anything wrong. Like maybe 10 years ago, you could get away with saying George Martin's not your bitch. And he's not. But does he owe nothing to the fans? Does he know nothing to his own legacy? Does he like, you know,
he doesn't have to finish him, but.
But I can talk shit about him if he don't.
Yeah.
Like that's how this works. I'm not anyone's bitch either. I'm just a guy talking in a microphone. People seem to like what I say. And I say George Martin needs to finish those books if he wants his legacy to be anything other than giant asterisks. Man wrote probably the best, finest fantasy this side of Tolkien, yet he didn't fucking write The Return of the King. Like Tolkien would, we wouldn't be talking about that. We wouldn't be doing Rings of Power if Tolkien had stopped at the Two Towers, people. Mm-hmm. What the fuck? Like, I get respecting creators and treating them as people, and I think we should definitely, but like, we can say that they're fucking up. And I think the Double D's fucked up. I think George Martin's actively fucking up, not finishing his books. Can't wait to see what kind of hot takes that's going to generate. But it's time for the Maesters to have their say in the Maesters Corner. Joining me now for the Maester's Corner, as he does each and every week, from our sister podcast, Double Dragon, Maester Anthony. Who's going first, you or me?
Yeah, I think you should go second here because I feel like your Maester's report is going to be explosive. It's going to change everything.
It could.
And mine's a little bit like ho hum.
You're the we got a Prince Doran Oberyn thing. I'm the flashy snake, and you're the snake in the grass, hidden in cover.
Right. Uh huh. Yeah, I felt like like, I found this research really interesting, and I hope folks appreciate that Martin's world is not exactly the medieval world. It's not like, okay, this is basically medieval England, except for they've got some dragons. There are some crucial differences here, and I'm bringing out one of the sort of the nitpicky differences between the real life medieval world and Martin's world this episode, in so much though I am interested in why Corlys Velaryon is so keen on having someone with his last name as king consort, because as you know, Aeron, last names did not actually begin until the 1100s.
Oh, yeah. Because so, I guess I was vaguely aware. What did they use before then?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good question.
You're just Aaron, so, because there's not more than one of you in the village.
So it's interesting. There's a number of reasons why you might have a last name. But let me just say, you know, in early medieval England, they were speaking French. So let's say that you did have a name that kind of went all the way back to French aristocracy. Here are some of the last names or some of the nicknames that these kings had, right? So you had like Louis the Lazy. Or you had Louis the Stammerer or Louis the Fat.
It's like Laris the Clubfoot. It's never anything. Yeah.
Yeah. Charles the Bald. Here's my favorite. My favorite is Louis the 11th, the Universal Spider.
The Universal Spider? That's got to have a story. Oh, my God.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a little bit odd that Corlys is like, I want, you know, the name out of the ancient past that's connected to my family to enter the... It's a little... In this way, Westeros is more like modern America than it is about medieval England. In Martin's world, you've got, like, the Velaryon families, you know, their names go all the way back to the old country. And then in, you know, the Starks, their names go all the way back to the First Men. Mm-hmm. But in real life, medieval England, these names are relatively new, mm-hmm. right? So why would you have them? Well, if you have like 1,000 Johns running around England, you might want a way to distinguish one John from the other.
Sure.
Right? So here's a few reasons why you might get a last name, right? So if your last name was MacArthur, that literally means son of Arthur, right? So that's pretty obvious. Right. You could have a name that's connected to a profession, like Cooper literally means cask maker. You could get a name connected to a place like Durham. You could get a name for an accomplishment, right? Like Longbow or Armstrong, you know, something that you're known for. You could also, your last name could also sort of reflect a well-known characteristic about you or your family. So like Little John would be an example. My last name is Ladon, which means the women. So probably somewhere in my lineage, there was sort of like a strong matriarchal presence. And I just, by the way, it is kind of true. Like the Ladons tend to produce these strong, assertive women. Mm,
the seed runs strong in the Ladon woman.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. So, for instance, that's why you might start getting a last name in, you know, the 11th century. But for aristocracy, it became a matter of inheritance. And I think this is more closely aligned to maybe, you know, Corlys's concerns. You were in a better position legally if you were known to be connected to your state. So all of a sudden, we have surnames become family names. Now, in Martin's world, the family names are like as old as the hills.
Right.
But in medieval England, they would have been rather new.
Mm.
And so basically, there were rules about what names you could take. And some countries forced certain names onto lower classes.
really?
And... Yeah, they didn't want people rising in social rank. And if there was a legal recourse to have, if you had a special name, They did. And for instance, Jews were prohibited from taking names associated with Christians in a lot of countries.
So like it's like because I know, you know, my family, German immigrants, things got pretty dicey here in the country around World War One. And a lot of my family anglicized their names just to avoid.
That's right.
We did not. We stayed true to the German roots. But a lot of them did. So they actually made it illegal for Jewish people to try to escape persecution in the same way. Damn, that's rough.
As soon as last names started carrying legal heft, there were absolutely rules on what kinds of names you could choose.
See, I was thinking
family.
That like, it's like, what, the nobility is going to make you be called Jimmy Pigpen, but it's more like you can't be called Jimmy Royal Blood. You know, it's like stuff, it's, you can't arise above your station more.
It depends. Like in Russia, sometimes they would force Jews to like take the last name Donkey Head.
You serious?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely.
That's
yeah, it's bad.
Well, I was just thinking that's a degrade. You watch like just like it's almost a parody of like Russian stupid, you know, medieval politics.
Yeah, I think in England it was more like, yeah, you can take that name, but you can't take this name.
You can't be a Thomas, so, possibly. No.
OK, so I don't know if you've ever heard of this book. This is a very well-known book that was published in the 30s. It's called How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Yeah.
My son is 15 and he wanted me to buy him this book, so I did. He's a very odd little fellow. So
that's anyway, a little finger in the making, man.
Absolutely. No, that's for sure. Okay, that was written by a guy named Dale Carnegie. Mm-hmm. And you might recognize that last name.
Sure.
He invented that last name. Like, in other words, I mean, that last name was well known because of industry. Mm-hmm. But he decided he was going to change his last name to Carnegie to sell more books because it's a name with prestige.
Yep.
That kind of stuff flies in America. That does not fly in the medieval world. That's exactly why these upper classes wanted to preserve their names and not allow the lower classes to use.
Yeah, can you imagine what Tywin would do if you tried to style yourself as Lannister? You're some base-born bastard.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's kind of what we're talking about with the Valyrians. It was a name like Rockefeller or Carnegie, it was a big name like that. It was a name like Kennedy. And in that way, I think it probably has more in line with the way we think about last names in the modern world. I think that his name is synonymous with wealth, with industry, with exploration. That's the name. It's a very old, prestigious name. And his idea about having a child on the throne with that name is kind of like gets them all hot and bothered. Mm-hmm. This is not something that they would have even considered to be the case in medieval England, because there were no old last names. There were no names going back to ancient Rome ancient Greece or ancient Egypt or something like that. So this is sort of a particular feature of Martin's world that makes it more like modern America and a little bit less like medieval times.
It feels like maybe it's also a connection to like older fantasy material like George. That's a very Tolkien thing, right? To have a name that goes back thousands of years.
Oh yeah, Bilbo Baggins. It's like, you know,
maybe the hobbits are a bad example, but yeah, like, you know, Aragorn of Arathorn. That's a name that goes back to the mighty kings of Numenor and the Edain.
That's
and all.
Right.
Yeah. So,
well, and I should mention that. I mean, that's interesting because you've got these different cultures in Middle Earth, but in that way, you know, the Chinese were doing last names like 3,000 years before the rest, before like modern Europe. So, or I should probably just say Europe in general. So there were ancient last names in other parts of the world.
Gotcha.
And I should probably call that out.
I'm going to talk about for the first time, you know, I'm as surprised as anyone to find out that we have been delving into material and we've hit a vein, a possible vein of Valyrian tinfoil. We've got a classic throwback spoiler theory section here.
I am so excited about this. You mentioned a little bit about this to me, and I've been waiting. I've been rubbing my hands together.
We don't know how rich this vein is going to be. Don't know how many good men and women are going to be down in the mines dying. But I've got word. I saw this. Kimren.
Well, should we give people warnings?
Yeah. This is one of those things where it's like, it's not really a spoiler because it's based on things we know from the books. And I'm not going to go into the particular details of that. But what has lit the spoiler crafters on fire is the fact that like show events, because we've seen time and time again where things happen in Fire and Blood and there's different possibilities and there's different emotional, you know, resonances and stuff. And then the show is kind of putting a definitive stamp on it. And when it's deviating from that, people are like, huh, wonder why. So this comes out of a YouTuber named Joe the Magician. I got this by way of a Kimren for a retweet. But it's raising the possibility. And again, if you don't want any kind of hints or predictions or things to look out for in the future, now is the time to stop the podcast. This is the theory of our buddy Laris. Laris Strong, the Clubfoot.
Okay.
Secret.
I love this
Green
guy.
Seer. So we have pointed out, Anthony, that canonically, no weirwood trees in the Godswood of King's Landing. On the show, Sansa's praying to a weirwood stump, which is consistent with the lore. In the books, they specify there is no weirwood stump or otherwise in the Godswood. It's just a white oak with some red vines going through it.
Yeah, this last episode really zooms in on the face. It's like they're almost hitting us over the head with the fact that they're all having these conversations.
It's no accident that we discovered this vein this week, because as you say, in House of the Dragon, there's always been a very prominent weirwood with a carved face in the Godswood there. And it was front and center this week. So what do we know about this Laris guy? Even if you've read the books, and we've both read Fire and Blood, I've read all the Dance of Dragons right before the season. I've been kind of reading a few pages, keeping up with the week. There's not much. There's countless theories and speculation about Laris's loyalty in the upcoming conflict, his motivations, but there's just not a lot to go on. And especially this week also blew open the idea of the Fire and Blood can say something like, oh, yeah, this lady, Royce, in the Vale, died of a hawking accident and passed away after an 8-day coma. And boy, that freed up Daemon to pursue these other interests. But Ryan Condal is like, you know what? Daemon murdered her. So keep in mind of all the different. So there's not a lot to go on. There's not a lot of actually things that he does. We know he's very smart. He's got a club foot and he knows things. Things that he might not have a direct reason for knowing.
Mm.
Like, you know, the Grand Maester making some plan tea, brewing that up for Rhaenyra late at night in her quarters.
Sure.
Currently, the Strongs hold Harrenhal, which is, you know, the very rich and profitable landownings that are attached to a very giant and haunted and ruined castle. And Laris probably grew up at or around Harrenhal. And one thing we know about Harrenhal is that it's settled on the northernmost shores of the God's Eye, which is the largest lake in Westeros. It's called the God's Eye because if you looked at it from an aerial view, it's got this big green island in the middle of it. And it looks like a big blue-eyed giant's eye, right? The other reason is that this is the central island, which is called the Isle of Faces, is a very special, unique place in Westeros. It's said to be the place thousands of years ago where the children of men made a pact with the first men that we're going to stop this butchering of each other. We're going to stay to the forest. You stay to the cleared areas in your fields. And that led to centuries, if not thousands of years, of peaceful coexistence and cultural exchange.
Well, yeah. And the God's Eye is famously like it's like maybe the most spiritual place in all of Westeros. You know, it's known to be like one of the, you know, the epicenter of weirwood magic.
Because like the children took the time to carve faces on every tree on that isle because they wanted the gods to take special notice of the vows taken there. So, yes, it's a very spiritually connected place. Like,
He's like God's Eye adjacent.
He's living next door to this nexus of weirwood power. So there's an order called the Green Men that were formed to guard and keep this island sacred. Some think the Green Men are residual children of the forest down into the Ned Stark period of Game of Thrones. Some think they're First Men type of shamans that are just running around wearing green antlers and antlers and green robes. Some think there's like a blend of the two. But what is known that anytime a riverman tries to cross the lake and enter the island, they're driven away by the stiff winds or flocks of ravens, which I think is hilarious because I'm like, why have the Maesters commissioned an expedition to this island? Like, they're just like, oh, cloud of ravens, got to give up. Like, here's some magic shit, Maesters. Come forge your Valyrian steel, Link, you pussies. But
well, if you've ever seen the birds, that's
true. You know, they get pecky.
These ravens can be really messy.
Yeah, they couldn't the Maesters have no couldn't wear a helm or anything. So anyway, God's Eye literally visible from the walls of Harrenhal. And the theory is that this forest held special interest to the young Laris growing up as a boy who has a physical impediment to his mobility, in a very similar way that Bran, after he was crippled, held a fascination for the First Men and warging and enabled his natural talents to manifest. The speculation is that at some point he crossed the lake and the Green Men, for whatever reason, accepted him, tootled him in their ways. Why? To what end? Who knows? I don't know. Nobody knows. We do know that 100 years from now, in the House of Dragon timeline, Brendan the Blood Raven Rivers, when the bastard Targaryens is going to journey north beyond the wall and merge with this Weirwood cave and become the Three-Eyed Raven, where he can essentially see everything in the realm using the Weirwood network and ravens and other beasts to spy and influence people through their dreams. But do we really think that he's the first to seek out or be called by this green seeing power to serve the gods or the realm or whatever the hell they're doing? George, finish your goddamn books. If true, the fact that the show is taking great pains to show us this Weirwood right here in the heart of the political center of Westeros might be a clue as to how Larys is getting his information.
So that's interesting to me because in disability studies, sometimes we talk about the super crip. I don't know if you've heard of this.
It sounds offensive, but...
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's right. it's sort of like the tendency in fiction to have a disabled character who then you endow with like superpowers.
A Daredevil.
So he can sort of make up Daredevil or Dr. X, or you could just go down the line. It's pretty typical. And of course we know that Martin likes this, right?
Professor X got a medical license. He's got upgraded to doctor, or he's just styling himself that.
Oh, did I say Dr. X?
And I was like, what the? Okay.
Yeah. No, honorary doctorate. I've just bestowed it.
Nice.
And we know for sure that Martin does traffic in these tropes because look no further than Bran the Broken, right?
Yep.
So, yeah, it would not be out of character for this particular show to play with a super crip trope. Now, I don't know if that makes this guy a greenseer. But I will say it's a fun thing.
And that's to say, if you ask me, gun the head, what is the plausibility of this on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being... Varys is the Merling King and 10 being Jon Snow is a secret Targaryen, I'm going to go with like a 3 because there's all the pieces here, but there's little direct evidence. And, you know, Larys could do all the things he's done in the show just by paying attention and listening to the ladies at court whispering. And you don't need the Weirwood there. But that's why it's not a 1 for me, is because you don't need a Weirwood here. In fact, you shouldn't have it. So the fact that that there is a Weirwood is going, you know, to play into some prominence. So,
I certainly do hope so. Like, I'm a fantasy lit fan. I kind of take the opposite view that like Steve takes or Jim takes. I want to see
you like
magic.
The magic, yeah.
I give me a little bit of magic. Certainly, this show has got dragons, and of course that connects to magic in some way. I would love to see the Weirwood tree be there for a purpose. And if it takes Laris Strong being a Green Seer, I will absolutely get on board. That guy is fascinating.
If you want to hear like 30 more minutes of like supporting evidence and going into the Weirwood Network and historical Weirwood users, I do encourage you to watch Joe the Magician's video on his Larry Strong Secret Green Seer theory, which will be linked in the show notes. Speaking of directing people's attention to places, Anthony, where can they find you if they want to continue with their thoughts on House of the Dragon? And I hear you're double timing it with the Rings of Power.
Oh, yes. So, Double Dragon. Just to do a search for Double Dragon. This week we cover episode 5. But in addition to that, medievalist Kavita Mudon Finn joins us to talk about colors of clothing in the medieval world. Did you know that there were actual laws about who could wear what color?
I'll believe anything now that you can make Jewish people be donkey heads and keep the pores from being royal.
Yeah, there were rules about who could wear what color. There were rules about who could wear what kind of fur. So you could absolutely, recognize someone's class by just the clothes that they're wearing. And this is a good episode to do that because, of course, a very prominent color was featured on a dress.
True.
Right. So anyway, as far as sort of me jumping on with the Lorehounds, we still have to figure out what that's going to look like. So, tune in to both Double Dragon and the Lorehounds to find that out.
All right. Thanks, Anthony. We'll see you next week on another Maester's Corner.
All right. Thanks, man.
And that'll do us for this week's House of the Dragon Hot D Feedback Podcast. If you'd like to leave us feedback for either Jim and I to consider or always ask to be considered for Maester Anthony in the Maester's Corner, send that in to hotd@baldmove.com. You can, of course, follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/baldmove, to stay up with everything that Bald Move's doing, all of our releases. You can join our Discord at discord.baldmove.com. We will be back Sunday night for the Instant Talk, Instant Take podcast that we do live, record live for our club members. And we release the Instant Take portion, but the talk portion remains private, just exclusively for our club members' enjoyment. If you'd like to get in on that fun, it's real easy. Support.baldmove.com. Get ad-free feeds and bonus content like the Instant Talk, Instant Take portions of our live reaction show on Sunday night. Can't wait for the next episode, and we'll see you guys then.